From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. This week, millions more Americans will be able to get the COVID-19 vaccine as more than a dozen states open eligibility for everyone over the age of 16. That includes states like Ohio, Kansas, and Oklahoma. But will it be enough to stem what health experts fear could be a fourth wave of infections? Yesterday, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky seemed to be near tears as she warned of impending doom and urged the public to stay vigilant. Let's bring in Keith Reed. He's Deputy Commissioner for Oklahoma's State Department of Health. Mr. Reed, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
You bet. And yesterday, your state expanded vaccinations to everyone over the age of 16, and your governor, Kevin Stitt, a Republican, wasted no time getting his dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Let's listen.
That's it?
Well done. Woo!
Okay. One bad.
Yeah.
All right, Stitt is 48, said he wanted to lead by example and encourage all Oklahomans to get a shot. But what's behind the decision to open up your eligibility to everyone?
Well, first of all, we've wanted to provide opportunities for as many Oklahomans as possible to get vaccinated as soon as possible. We've been very intentional about the way we've rolled out our program, overlapping eligibility within our priority groups to make sure that we don't waste time waiting on people, quite frankly, to make their decision to get vaccinated. We've done a good job of getting vaccine to our 65-plus population, making it available to many access points around the state. So we were in a position we felt like we had good supply and felt like it was time to open it up to all those that were in the 16-plus categories.
Well, many states are opening appointments to those people because they're running out of others who wanted to get a shot, and appointments were going unfilled. Was that a concern there in Oklahoma?
Yeah, one of the early indicators that we've always watched for as we made decisions to move to our next priority groups is if we start to have unfilled capacity, that it's time to add on new groups. So we have started to see in some of our rural areas that we had some unfilled capacity, and for us, that was an indication it is time to bring on more people, because we don't want to lose opportunities because we have capacity that is going unfilled and unused.
Well, and tell me more about that. Does it suggest that you have a potential problem in those areas with vaccine hesitancy and that you may not get the immunity that you need to keep people safe?
Well, we're hoping that's not the case. We do know that we are going to have some issues around vaccine hesitancy. So part of our strategy has been to make sure that we do open it up to all those that are committed to getting the vaccine as soon as possible. And in doing so, give those that are hesitant more time to observe the program, to gain confidence in the vaccine, that it is safe and it is effective. Just because
is that why you brought the governor out there to get that shot publicly to help convince those folks to come on board?
Well, the governor was ready with phase four. That was one of the groups he was waiting on, and he was ready to get his vaccine, and he wanted to lead by example. And we do feel like it's important that public figures like the governor get out there and send that message to our residents that it's something that they can do to help stem the tide of COVID.
I'm sure you saw CDC Director Rochelle Walensky yesterday pleading with states and with people to stay vigilant as case numbers and hospitalizations are rising again overall across the country. Let's listen to this.
We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared.
She says she's scared. Do you share her concern that a fourth wave of infections is coming and that it could be very dangerous?
Well, we're obviously concerned that there is the risk of a resurgence of COVID. We've been fortunate that our numbers are down, both hospitalizations and cases. Right now, we're pretty level in Oklahoma, staying at a compared to what we've seen on recent months. But absolutely, we're concerned, and we do feel like a strong vaccination program is the way to keep COVID at bay. So there's obviously a concern that if we don't have a strong vaccination program, and while this program is rolling out, we don't continue with mitigation efforts, that there is a risk of resurgence of COVID.
Well, on the other hand, your state is relaxing other mitigation efforts. Your governor has dropped restrictions on public gatherings, ended a mask requirement in state buildings. What's to stop the number of cases and hospitalizations and deaths from going back up again if people aren't staying vigilant at the governor's request?
Well, we're certainly encouraging our residents to take personal responsibility about wearing masks, social distancing, washing our hands. We know that there is a lot of weariness out there about COVID. People are tired, and we know it's hard. That's a difficult message when people are looking forward to the summer, but we just strongly encourage them to remain vigilant, recognize and embrace the opportunities that getting vaccinated offers. When we talk about the new CDC recommendations where you can get together in small groups, hopefully that serves as an incentive for residents to get vaccinated and do their part to get this pandemic behind us.
Keith Reed is Deputy Commissioner for Oklahoma's State Department of Health. The state of Oklahoma has opened its vaccine program to anyone over the age of 16. Keith, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Many of you may remember this moment in history. On March 30th, 1981, President Ronald Reagan had just finished a speech at the Washington Hilton Hotel. As he was walking toward his limousine, waving to the crowd on the sidewalk, shots rang out.
Shots have been fired at President Reagan. According to initial reports, the president was not injured. He has been returned to
the initial news bulletin turned out to be wrong. Reagan was seriously wounded, but he survived. We would later learn that the would-be assassin was a young man named John Hinckley, who believed the attack would impress the actress Jodie Foster. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he joins us now. Julian, hard to believe this was 40 years ago and such a different world, especially with regard to news coverage.
Absolutely. This is a moment. The Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States was very hot, with fears that a nuclear war was still possible. It was a moment when the idea of assassination was very real for many adult Americans. They remember John F. Kennedy being killed in 63, or Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King in 68. And cable news was really new. CNN just went on the air in June 1980, and news coverage still primarily meant, for most Americans, the three major networks, a handful of major city newspapers and radio stations.
Well, after President Reagan was shot, Secretary of State Alexander Haig famously said he was, quote, in charge. It seemed like there was a tremendous amount of chaos in the government at that moment. Remind us what happened.
Well, some of the chaos was just the aftermath of an assassination attempt where people were scared. They were getting news that wasn't often correct and trying to figure out what was happening. George H.W. Bush, the vice president, was on his way back from Texas. And in the middle of this, Secretary of State Al Haig says he's in control at a press conference. The 25th Amendment doesn't stipulate that he would be the person in control. That would, after the vice president, be the Speaker of the House. But he says this, and it creates this impression for the public and even for people in the administration that no one really knows what's going on and that the situation is a little bit out of control with the president incapacitated.
Well, White House Press Secretary James Brady was also seriously wounded that day. He suffered brain damage. He was paralyzed. And later he became a prominent voice against gun violence. And it's so interesting to consider Brady's work now, given the sheer number of mass shootings we have experienced as a country in recent years.
Yes, and his name is associated with legislation that would ultimately be pushed through when President Bill Clinton was in office. But increasingly, the Republican Party is at odds with issues like gun control. And the kind of argument that was made by Brady and for Brady after he was struck and severely injured just seems to have vanished from the landscape of the GOP.
Well, the assassination attempt was just 2 months into Ronald Reagan's presidency. He won a landslide re-election victory over Democrat Walter Mondale in 1984. Republicans often invoke Ronald Reagan as an icon of the party. How do you see his legacy today, Professor? And would he even recognize the Republican Party as it exists in 2021?
Well, I think we can't forget that for a lot of the United States, Reagan wasn't politics as usual. He was actually pretty radical, and you can see the seeds of what would happen to the Republican Party begin during the 1980s. The rampant partisanship, the backlash politics, the conservative shift on issues like taxation and deregulation, they were all happening with Reagan. So It starts then. But that said, the party has radicalized, and the divisions that were still present when Reagan was president are no longer there. The party is very much on the same page, and it's a rightward page. And so right now, Reagan might be surprised, even though if he looked back at his presidency, I think he could see where things were going to go.
Professor, I have 20 seconds left. What do you remember from that day 40 years ago?
Just a sense of shock and confusion, and watching on television as a Generation Xer, watching this unfold and just not knowing what was coming next, who did it, and what this would all add up to.
40 years after the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan, Julian Zelizer is Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Professor, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Over the past year or so, people have been having debates, even arguments, with friends and family, strangers, about wearing a mask to prevent the spread of coronavirus, or whether you should get vaccinated against it. Add on to that the heated conversation we're having again about guns following mass shootings in Georgia and Colorado, and you've got what seems like a real moment emerging to talk about personal freedom, liberty, and responsibility. George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist and philosopher, also a professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, author of many books, including Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
A pleasure to be here.
And what a moment we've been in. For over a year now, we've been debating the personal responsibility of mask wearing or not mask wearing, and now we're back into these tense conversations about our liberties around gun ownership. Why does this theme keep emerging?
Well, first, there's the question about what your responsibility is when you have liberty. Do you have responsibility to other people? Liberty comes through legitimate authority, usually through political authority. The question then is, if you have liberty in that way, do you have responsibilities to other people who have liberty? That is, you're not free to limit other people's freedom. And that's a very important idea. Being free doesn't mean you stop other people's freedom.
Right. So, I mean, we have First Amendment speech, but the classic example is you can't yell fire into a crowded theater. We have Second Amendment gun rights, but you aren't allowed to just randomly shoot somebody on the street. Is that nuance something that we Americans are equipped to understand?
Well, we're equipped to understand it simply intuitively, because democracy requires empathy. Democracy requires caring about other people. Without empathy, without the very idea of caring about other people, there can be no notion of democracy.
Hmm. So you're a linguist, and it sounds like you're saying to me that the definition of liberty is not the same necessarily as freedom.
Oh, not at all. Liberty has to do with a legitimate authority imposing a freedom within the range of the laws given by that legitimate authority. So liberty is a political notion. Freedom is sort of neutral.
So this conversation applies to guns. It applies to masks, many other things in this country's discourse. How do politicians use the language of freedom and liberty to suit their goals?
Well, in general, Republicans tend to talk more about freedom and less about liberty. And that's an important thing, because liberty has to do with politics. Liberty has to do with legitimate authority, not just any authority, legitimate or not. And that's an important distinction in American politics.
Here's Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis speaking to conservatives last month about taking a hands-off approach to the coronavirus. I think it's going to get to some of what we're talking about.
We are an oasis of freedom in a nation that's suffering in many parts of the country under the yoke of oppressive lockdowns. We look around in other parts of our country, and in far too many places, we see schools closed, businesses shuttered, and lives destroyed.
What do you hear there?
Oppressive lockdowns. That is, public health That is doing what is necessary to, you know, maintain public health under a pandemic, is seen as oppressive. Oppressive to who? The answer is oppressive to those, you know, companies and folks that don't care about whether or not they're contributing to the coronavirus or contributing to other dangers to public health.
What's the effect of using a phrase like that, the yoke even of oppressive lockdown?
The effect is to say that government that cares about its people is not legitimate. That's the effect. It says that people are free, independent of what its government says about taking care of the health and well-being of the people at large.
Let's listen to the way Democrats might handle something like this. Here's Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer commenting last week on legislation that's been proposed to restrict access to guns following the recent shootings.
We cannot seem to finish grieving one tragedy before another takes place. It's a reminder that we must confront a devastating truth in the United States. An unrelenting epidemic of gun violence steals innocent lives with alarming regularity.
So what did you hear there? And do liberals approach the language of freedom and liberty differently than conservatives?
Very, very differently. Take the question of whether anybody ought to be able to go out and buy an AR-15. You know, what Schumer is saying is no.
Is there anything that you're hearing now in this modern discourse that's any different than how we once discussed these principles?
Well, there was a time at which, you know, AR-15 kind of weapons were banned due to the work of Dianne Feinstein.
California senator, yeah.
You know, that was changed by Republicans in Congress who are supported by gun manufacturers. I mean, this is not a great idea that gun manufacturers and gun salesmen should be able to affect our national politics.
But go back even further than that, and I mean way back, like to the founding days of this country, when the country held up these virtues of liberty and freedom as sort of like what it meant to be American.
In those days, you had, if you wanted to shoot a rifle, you had to put a bullet, which is a round ball, in it with gunpowder, stuff it down and so on, you know, before you could shoot one shot. I mean, things were very different then. You know, there were no AR-15s and huge magazines on guns and so on. So the idea of Second Amendment rights were, you know, if you still had the right to just have that kind of a rifle, you know, there wouldn't be a whole lot of gun violence around.
Hmm. Can we get past having fights about guns and masks and actually have a productive conversation? I mean, what's your expectation and your advice to people who are seeking that?
I don't think we can get by it. I mean, this is part of the politics of our country. You know, it is part of conservatism these days that you should be able to have guns, period. And this is part of what the Republican Party is supporting. When you have a national party doing this, that's dangerous.
George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist and a philosopher, also a professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Another big debate in the country right now is about who should be eligible for the vaccine and the moral responsibility of those not eligible to wait patiently for their turn. Yet despite those criteria, there are still plenty of ways for young, healthy people to jump the line just to get a shot. California college student Natalie Bettendorf says she has mixed feelings about that. Here's her essay from YR Media.
In February, a friend from my school was able to get vaccinated. He told me over the phone while I was making dinner. I paused from confusion. Wait, how? My friend, who prefers to remain anonymous to avoid public shaming, told me there are loopholes in the California eligibility guidelines. Sure, you can't change the fact that you're younger than 65 years old, but you can alter your worker status. By signing up to volunteer with nonprofits offering community relief, you could become eligible for the vaccine by working a shift at a vaccination site or distributing clean water to homeless people. My friend and four of his roommates signed up to volunteer with one of those organizations, and they were able to get vaccinated at Dodger Stadium within days as healthcare workers. My friend has diabetes, but is otherwise young, healthy, and active. College students with high internet literacy and free time during remote learning have the ability to take advantage of a flawed system. Weeks after my friend got the vaccine, I got an email from my employer about my vaccine eligibility. Since I'm a literacy tutor for fourth graders in Los Angeles public schools, I qualified as an educator in California's Phase 1B. I immediately scheduled my appointment for the following weekend. I received my shot and afterward drove up to the tent where they were verifying why vaccine recipients were eligible. When an older woman asked me what my job was, my heart sped up. I stumbled over my words, over-explaining that I was a tutor, which meant I was an educator. "Okay, you're a teacher," she chuckled. "That's all I needed to know." Why did I feel like I was lying? Probably because I'm a college student, not a teacher. I was honestly eligible, doing a job that I worked for months already with no plans to use it to get the vaccine. LA is full of vaccine jumpers who seem to have no remorse about getting the shot before more vulnerable people or essential workers. I have friends who have signed up for DoorDash and Postmates to receive the vaccine in what qualifies as a food worker in Phase 1B. At the end of the day, every person vaccinated is a win for the rest of society. But part of me still feels like I slipped into a loophole and that my vaccine could have gone to someone else. I'm not sure how long it will matter, if at all, how you got the vaccine, but we'll certainly remember who got it first, ahead of someone who needed it more. For Here and Now, I'm Natalie Bettendorf.
Natalie is 22 and a college student in Los Angeles. Her essay was produced by YR Media.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Protests continued today in Myanmar despite a deadly crackdown by government security forces. More than 500 demonstrators have been killed since the military coup on February 1st, including more than 100 on Saturday alone. That's according to Myanmar's Assistance Association for Political Prisoners. The BBC's South Asia editor, Anbarasan Etarajan, is following the story from Delhi, and he's on Skype. And what are you hearing about what's going on in Myanmar today?
While the violence is continuing in Myanmar with the army and the police, they are trying to control the various protests. People are fleeing Myanmar because some of them are local police officers who have refused to take the orders to shoot at these protesters in different parts of the country. On the one side, you have people trying to enter into Thailand, that is from the southern part of Myanmar. And there was a video which was shown on various news outlets which said, the Thai police were trying to push them back into Myanmar. Now, the protests have been continuing since this coup in early February, and it is now spreading to different parts. But people do realize that they have to save their lives and move into different parts, neighboring countries. For example, in India, the northeastern states of Mizoram and Manipur, they are seeing arrivals from Myanmar.
Well, the military coup ousted the civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi. Where is she now? And can she do anything about what's happening?
She has been in-house custody for a number of weeks. And she was accused of misusing the government funds for a while. And she made a brief court appearance. But after that, people have not heard much about Aung San Suu Kyi, where she is. And the whole thing happened, because her party won convincingly late last year's elections, and the military did not expect that. and they did not want to honor the election verdict, and that led to the whole the issue of military coup, and she was arrested and put in house arrest. And people are now, the local leaders are trying to lead the movement because they know once they stop this movement, and then the military will establish its control over the rest of the country. Many sections of the society, that is what is interesting. You know, Myanmar, it's not simply that supporters of Aung San Suu Kyi are protesting. It is like the doctors, the police officer, the civil servant. And they are not afraid because we have a producer back in Myanmar, and he was sending films or some of the short phone videos where he was trying to shoot, and the police do not even hesitate to open fire at the direction of where he was filming. People are basically, they're not even afraid of this danger, and trying to send a message to the outside world because they think the outside world should know what is happening inside Myanmar. So the reports, the credit to all these people, these activists who are using their own phones and take whatever they can and send the message out, that makes them the real heroes because they think, the democracy has to be reestablished. I was in Myanmar a couple of years ago where people were enjoying, late nights and dinners, and then you have the youths going to the clubs. All these things have been, taken away, and then, protests are coming back, and they do not want to go back to the era of the military dictatorship, and that's why they're defying the authorities despite dangers to their lives.
Well, we are so grateful for your excellent reporting and for bringing it to us today. That's the BBC South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan speaking with us from Delhi about the situation in Myanmar. Anbarasan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a contentious day in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd last year. Attorneys for both sides frequently objected during witness testimony. Darnella Frazier was the teenager who took the now infamous video of Chauvin pressing his knee into Floyd's neck. Here's her testimony describing that moment for the prosecution.
I heard George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe, please get off of me. I can't breathe." He cried for his mom. He was in pain. It seemed like he knew. It seemed like he knew it was over for him.
Minnesota Public Radio's Reham Fashir joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we heard some emotional testimony there from Darnella Frazier. Also today, Donald Williams, he was the bystander who confronted Chauvin at one point, told him to get off of Floyd, to stop restraining him. What were some of the other key moments from today's testimony?
Yeah, so Donald Williams is a wrestler and a mixed martial arts fighter. So not only did he watch the entire thing play out, he said he tried to warn the police officers that the move was dangerous according to his training. He described it as a blood choke that cuts off oxygen, and that he saw Floyd gasping for air after Derek Chauvin continued pressing his knee and shimmying it back and forth into George Floyd's neck. You also heard, just now from Darnella Frazier, she's on the stand, and she said she felt threatened by Chauvin and the other cops because they pulled out mace every time someone from the crowd tried to get closer. She saw Floyd in pain, crying out for his mom, and that Chauvin knelt even harder instead of getting up.
Well, why did attorneys on both sides object so much during these testimony?
So it all goes back to what is allowed into evidence and what's not. And it can get complicated when witnesses are testifying and in the moment talking about their reaction to something. So objections happened a lot during Donald Williams' testimony because he has so much experience in martial arts. He can talk about what he saw, and he can talk about his training and, warning the police officers about the dangerous move and everything like that. But he can't really draw conclusions. That's what the court ordered, is that they can't really draw conclusions from what they saw because they're not expert witnesses, and that's left to expert witnesses who will testify, like the medical examiner. So and this is all because the cause of death is such a highly contested issue, whether it's the knee that killed George Floyd or whether it's something else, as the defense has said.
All right. Minnesota Public Radio's Reham Fashir, thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome.
The NCAA college basketball tournament in all its madness is marching on to a finish this week. Tonight for the men, it's USC and Gonzaga and UCLA versus Michigan. For the women, it's the Texas Longhorns versus the South Carolina Gamecocks and Louisville versus Stanford. COVID-19 has limited in-person fans during the tournament. In this weekend's Final Four matchups, fan cutouts, those life-size photo poster boards, will fill some of the seats. They're raising money for charity, and some are keeping alive the memory of loved ones lost during the pandemic. Let's bring in Joe DiPietro, who makes those fan cutouts. He's co-founder of the media company Perk Social. Joe, welcome to Here and Now.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. So these fan cutouts have become a real thing at sporting events. They're such a sign of our times, right? What does it say to you about fandom right now, Joe?
Oh, it has been a wild ride for us since we started this. And to see all the fans that want to be a part of their team, this is just keeps going. Even with some fans entering and being able to be there, we're still seeing people that are still a little nervous about getting into an enclosed event that are uploading their cutouts to show their team and show their support for the community. So it's been very cool to see.
Well, the proceeds from the cutouts in the stands, at least in the Final Four games this coming weekend, will benefit a number of charities. What are you hearing from fans about why they're buying these cutouts, Joe?
It's a very mixed reaction. You know, some people just want to support NCAA basketball for the Final Four. There's a lot of people, I was surprised to see this, a lot of people go every year, doesn't matter what team is there. And so since they can't be there this year, they wanted to put their cutouts there. Obviously, if their team is doing well, they're wanting to support their team. Yeah, the charity aspect of it, I really do think pushes people over the edge, saying, you know, this is kind of a silly thing to do, but at least the money's going to good charities. So we do see that aspect as well. We also have memorial photos happening. So this has happened throughout all the teams that we've worked with, where it's somebody that has passed away, maybe from COVID, maybe from something else, and they just want to sit with them again in some capacity.
Well, we're going to hear from a fan with a poignant story in just a moment, but describe some of the funniest cutouts you've made for fans.
Oh, it's been across the board. I mean, we have seen fish and horses. We almost always have a Where's Waldo show up, no matter what team or event we're doing. Somebody decides to dress up as Waldo. We have definitely had, again, people just dressing up from like Halloween costumes that fit their team. You have the super fans that you can tell this is what they wear to every game. But I would say an odd number of fish. People holding fish, you know, people with their fish, you know, like their goldfish. It's really been an interesting thing to see.
Interesting. Maybe a bit odd, but interesting. Joe, thank you so much. Let me bring in a couple of Michigan fans. Andrew Kelto got a fan cutout made for his good friend Zach Boucher. Zach's dad, Dan, passed away from COVID-19 last month. Zach, I'm so sorry. I appreciate you both being with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Zach, what does this cutout mean to you? Why is it important?
Well, it means a lot to me because, as you mentioned, a lot of fans, some fans go to it every year, and it's been a tradition for myself, my dad, and a group of family friends since 2009 when we went to one in Detroit. We were hooked right then. So we've gone every year since then. Obviously, last year we couldn't because it got canceled, but it's something we wanted to continue doing, you know, as long as he was going to live. We didn't expect him to die this soon, but it's kind of a touching tribute that the tradition gets to live on, that we're still part of the Never Miss a Final Four club because our cutouts will be still sitting in the stands there. Mm.
Andrew, why did you want to make this cutout for Zach and his late father?
Yeah, you know, I grew up with Zach, and then I actually lived with Zach all through college at the University of Michigan alongside four other great friends. And we actually all wanted to get together. You know, it's an extremely difficult time, and we wanted to try to do something to honor Dan's memory. And we thought, what better way than, you know, allow Zach and Dan to be at the Final Four again this year together in the stands. So, you know, we just wanted to do anything we could to, you know, kind of put a smile on Zach's face and, you know, help him out in this time.
Was there a special picture you chose for the cutout, Zach?
Well, they did it as a surprise, actually. I wasn't involved in it at all. They kind of caught me off guard and, you know, really brought a tear to my eye. But It's a very honoring tribute. There was a picture of us right before this whole virus thing hit. We were on a cruise down in the Caribbean, and that was our last vacation that we had together, and it kind of meant a lot, and it feels like he's still there.
So what does this game mean to you, Zach?
Well, I'd like to think that he's up there right now kind of putting in a good word for the Wolverines, because they're on a pretty good run right now, and I hope he can keep doing so as they push forward to the Final Four. And it means so much to me. Every year is our favorite vacation that we go to, and anytime Michigan was there was always a great added bonus. Mm.
Andrew, it must be extra special that Michigan wins and makes it to the Final Four, so your cutouts will be there on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely the hope. I know I'll be yelling at my TV trying to make that happen.
And you can ask for the cutouts once the tournament is over. Zach, what are you going to do with it?
Well, I've actually just recently redone my basement. It's sort of a man cave, Michigan theme, so I'll probably find a spot for him down there so he can watch more games with me in the future.
Well, our best to you both. A beautiful tribute, Andrew Kelto and Zach Boucher. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And Joe DiPietro. He's co-founder of Perk Social, the company behind the fan cutouts at the NCAA basketball tournament. Joe, thanks to you.
Thanks for having us.
Amazon employees in Bessemer, Alabama have voted on whether or not to form a union. It would be a first in the company's history. Federal officials are counting the votes of some 5,800 warehouse workers who've cast ballots by mail over the last 7 weeks. It could take days, though, to get the final results. The union drive has already heartened labor activists who see it as a bellwether for the national labor movement. But the attention on Bessemer has also renewed criticism of Amazon's business practices, and that has irritated company executives, including the man at the top, CEO Jeff Bezos, according to a new report from Recode. Jason Del Rey is a senior correspondent for Recode, and he's been reporting on this. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you.
And before I dive in, I do need to say that Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. But that said, catch us up. What's the latest on this union vote?
Sure. So all the votes are in as of today, Tuesday, but now there's the counting of the votes. And even before that happens, both sides, the union and Amazon, you know, go through each ballot and can contest a vote based on whether the person in question still works at the company, whether they're actually a manager and not a frontline worker. You know, my hope is we get results this week, but there's even a chance it stretches into next week.
So as I said, this would be the first union of Amazon warehouse workers in the U.S. And because of that, very powerful people are watching. President Biden, Bernie Sanders, and even Republican Senator Marco Rubio, they've all expressed to varying degrees some support for this drive. And that has put a lot of pressure on Amazon, which took the unusual step last week of responding to some of its critics on Twitter. What happened?
That's right. So, you know, it's not uncommon for Amazon to necessarily respond to critics that they believe are putting out misleading or inaccurate information about the company. It is unusual to do it in sort of a snarky tone, which is what we saw in a variety of tweets last week aimed at Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, and a few other people. And, you know, what I found in my reporting is that maybe not surprisingly to people who know Amazon well, this came from the top. Jeff Bezos had expressed to his team in recent weeks that they weren't sort of being aggressive enough when combating criticism of the company that they believe, like I said, is either misleading or inaccurate. And I think there's a general feeling at the top of the company that's like, you know, we pay our warehouse workers pretty well compared to, you know, our competitors. They have health benefits. Now we're being attacked. There's these anecdotes about peeing in a bottle, which we don't think are accurate. And so this was, I mean, on one hand, a little bit, it seemed like a lack of discipline. But on the other hand, what Bezos wanted done.
Well, let's be clear here and actually talk about some of the tweets that are happening. Dave Clark, an executive at Amazon, tweeted at Bernie Sanders. He said, "I welcome Senator Sanders to Birmingham and appreciate his push for a progressive workplace. I often say we are the Bernie Sanders of employers, but that's not quite right because we actually deliver a progressive workplace. So, you know, that's one of the examples of the tweets that we're talking about. You also mentioned another congressman was talking about this allegation that the people have to pee in bottles because the production quotas are so tight at Amazon. This is sort of rare for a company of this size to have such a public spat on Twitter, isn't it? How did it go over, both inside Amazon and outside?
Yeah, so it's very rare. I will say there are, you know, on and off occasions over the last couple of years where Amazon executives have sort of, you know, used the tone that is not necessarily normal for a big corporation. That said, outside and inside the company, the reaction was mixed, but I saw a lot more of the, I can't believe a company thinks this is an appropriate way to talk to U.S. senators. Internally, in fact, I reported that a security engineer at the company filed sort of a support ticket because he thought that the tweets were so out of the ordinary and inappropriate that they might be the result of someone sort of either hacking into Amazon's Twitter accounts or just someone internally who wasn't supposed to have access, gaining access. And I've since learned also there were some social media employees who raised similar alarms internally and were told essentially, No, like management's got this.
Well, you say it came from the top. It was Jeff Bezos who was encouraging people to fight back. Do you know why?
Yeah, in short, I think Amazon executives and Jeff Bezos specifically feel like they are a force for good, feel like they pay pretty well, feel like they are misunderstood, and, you know, in many ways still feel like they're that young up-and-coming company that, you know, is battling the big bad titans of, you know, industry. I think they lose sight sometimes of who they are today. And this is the result.
Some of the drama surrounding this union drive in Bessemer, Alabama. We're going to keep a close eye on how that vote is going. It would have big implications potentially for the labor movement across the country and for Amazon. Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent for Recode. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.